Hello, this is Lisa with the News Gazette for June 23rd, 2026. And let's begin with an article about weather, both recent and upcoming. This article is titled "By the Numbers of Storms Toll and a Fourth Forecast." Tornadoes for Illinois so far in 2026, 14.9. The figure marks a state record for a calendar year, said the National Weather Service meteorologist Alex Irwin, and he expects this number to increase as surveys are completed on Sunday's inclement weather survey. These surveys will take about 2 to 3 more days to finalize. 39 tornadoes in the land of Lincoln over the last 2 weeks. According to Irwin, this includes 7 tornadoes on June 10th, 22 on June 11th, and 10 on June 17th. Central Illinois in particular saw 12 tornadoes during the first two-day event and another 7 the following week, according to the National Weather Service Lincoln office. 250 trees have been damaged or snapped at Kickapoo State Recreational Area by an EF1 tornado on June 11th, according to estimates. The tornado had estimated peak winds of 110 miles per hour and a track length of 13.6 miles. The tornado lifted along Hungry Hollow Road just before moving into Danville, the agency reported. Damage in Danville itself was determined to be from straight-line winds of 80 to 100 miles per hour. An 88-degree high forecast for the 4th of July has been announced by the Weather Channel. So the current outlook for the United States' 250th birthday is mostly sunny with only a 24% chance of rain. And here's another article of local interest titled "Built on a Good Work Ethic." Parkland College names Justin Kirby as Distinguished Alumnus of the Year. When Philo native Justin Kirby was figuring out what he wanted to do with his life, he took his father's words to heart. "He always told me he wanted me to work with my brain more than my back," he said. That advice presumably came from the elder Kirby's experience with a career as a butcher. "We always wanted a little more for our kids than we have for ourselves, and I think he was a meat cutter, so he stood in a refrigerator on concrete for 9 hours a day," Kirby said. "That wears on your knees and your back and everything else. I definitely remember that. My dad's a hard worker, the hardest worker I know, so he taught us work ethic," he said. "If you've got a good work ethic, you can get jobs and you can do okay." Kirby channeled that work ethic into becoming the first person in his family to earn a college degree and founding Kirby Wealth Management, which manages over $1 billion in client assets. The CEO's dedication and success have earned him the honor of being named Parkland College's 2026 Distinguished Alumnus. "The life lessons that it taught me, having to continue my education, continue to learn and grow, it's a big part of who I am today," he said. Upon entering eighth grade, Kirby gave up baseball and became heavily involved in golf, which lasted throughout his time at Unity High School. It didn't have a golf team, so he and his friend, Matt Althaus, whom he still plays with to this day, pestered their principal into serving as golf coach so they could compete during their junior and senior years. "We got good enough where we were convinced the principal to basically be our coach and enter us into some events," he said. "We got to play at state, which was fun." At 16, he joined the grounds crew at a nearby golf course. His summer days consisted of tending to the course from 5 a.m. to 10 a.m., playing golf until 3 p.m., then clocking into work at the pro shop until 9 p.m. He also worked at the Philo Tavern from fifth grade to the end of college. I spent a lot of time at the golf course, meeting and getting to know people, he said. It was a blessing. Golf is a great game. Upon graduating, Kirby received a scholarship to play golf at Parkland, an offer he couldn't refuse. Additionally, he opted to study business. Golf takes a lot of perseverance, not unlike starting a business, he said. While at Parkland, he took an internship at Northwestern Mutual in 1995 and stayed while continuing his education for 2 years at Illinois State University. Upon earning his bachelor's degree, he went full-time with the financial services giant, which is where he's been since. Slowly, the worlds of golf and business started to mix. An already social game mixed with business helped create clients. Selling products that people don't necessarily want to think about, which is life insurance, he said. Most people don't wake up and go, man, I want to buy some life insurance today. Unlike the latest iPhone, life insurance doesn't have people lining up at the doors, he said. But his time playing golf helped him grow and hone his tenacity. He didn't mope about rejections, he said, because there's always someone out there who could be a buyer. Kirby said starting his collegiate career at Parkland was a great experience, and he knows a roster full of successful people who attended, so to be given one of the top honors for an alum shocked him. I think Parkland is a crown jewel of our community, he said. When you have the University of Illinois in your backyard, they get all the press and limelight, but there are people that have benefited from Parkland in our community and all over the world. Turning now to an opinion piece, this article is titled The War on Science and Beyond. It's written by Paul Selvin, who's a professor of physics and biophysics at the U of I. While the war being waged against Iran has understandably made headlines, there's another war that is much less visible and doesn't involve the loss of lives, for now. The Trump administration has recently published a 412-page proposal about funding the more than $180 billion in science grants given out by the federal government each year. While you may not be a scientist, this does involve you if you have benefited from the medicine that saves lives, from polio and HIV, for example, or basic physics that led to things like transistors, cell phones, and computers. Locally, it also involves possible funding cuts to the University of Illinois or everyday things like food assistance. The proposal says funding should not be based on scientific merits, but instead be led by political appointees whose primary concern is to prevent so-called woke research that may, quote, promote anti-American values, end quote. Yes, the term promote anti-American values is in the regulation, section 200.205. Does this remind you of Joe McCarthy, the 1950s senator who led the highly publicized and unsupported accusations of un-American activities in an attempt to silence opposition? The current scientific method relies on peer review, where teams of scientists from the government, industries, and universities evaluate whether a proposal is likely to succeed. Of course, the method is inexact, but at least it's based on the idea that the best science wins, based on scientific merits. In fact, the proposed regulation extends the specifics of science, Elizabeth Genexi, a 22-year-old National Institute, a 22-year National Institutes of Health program official overseeing federally funded scientists, says. She states, "The more I have dug into this rule, the more I realize that scientists are not the only ones who should be alarmed, not even close." She estimates that there is $1.1 trillion of federal aid given every year to state and local governments involving Medicaid, transportation, education, and food assistance. That's 36 cents of every dollar a state spends, she says. In Illinois, it's 32%. If the new regulations take place, a grant, either current or pending, not in the broadly defined national interest, could be stopped. Note that the recent proposal is a regulation, meaning it becomes law after an initial comment period. These have real impacts here at the U of I. Most professors are unwilling to speak out publicly, but they tell a consistent story. Consider that one untenured professor who recently got a very good score on his National Institute of Health grant is left waiting and hoping to see the money. Given that a grant from the National Institute of Health is considered mandatory for tenure, his future depends on it. Yet, the Office of Management and Budget, whose job is to disperse money from the National Science Foundation and National Institute of Health, has operated so slowly that the number of awards given out to NIH recipients has declined by 66% in the last year. Another professor had to rewrite his proposal a year after it was approved so that it would, quote, align with new priorities, end quote. Yet another professor is left scientifically homeless as his area of research suddenly disappeared from the NIH. ANASA-funded professor had to stop work on his South Pole Observatory as the money was pulled. At the beginning of May, the director of biology at the National Science Foundation, which recently lost a third of its staff, gave a talk at the U of I where he said that scientists will need to realign their priorities to deal with the new realities. Why is the Trump administration so against science, especially at the National Institute of Health, which is the world's leading biomedical research enterprise? Perhaps President Donald Trump can indirectly answer this question. Less than 2 months ago, Trump published an image created by artificial intelligence of himself dressed like the Pope. May I suggest he is more like the Pope of the 1600s when the Catholic Church tried, unsuccessfully, to kill the idea that the Earth was not at the center of the universe, as proposed by Copernicus. Giordano Bruno of Rome was burned at the stake in 1600 because he defended the Copernican theory. Fundamental science has the ability to upend current beliefs, however much political leaders may disagree with them. Vidya Manhavan, head of the physics department at the U of I, suggests submitting a comment regarding the new federal proposal by July 13th, the deadline for public comment. Then Congress can pass a Congressional Review Act to overturn the regulation. My graduate students have, perhaps wisely, said that I should not take such a public stand since I am dependent on funding from the NIH and NSF. My laboratory does fundamental research into the cause of Alzheimer's disease. Is writing this column considered un-American? And let's follow that with another opinion column. This one is written by Janice Jays, who lives in Champaign and teaches in the History Department at Illinois State University. She's a regular contributor to the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center's newspaper, The Public Eye. This article is called A Soberly Fitting Sequel to the Disastrous War on Terror. Declare victory and go home already. What a colossal waste. For more than a year, the U.S. has carried out economic, then military war on Iran, culminating in a bombing blitz with targeted assassination strikes this spring. Predictably, the war spiraled into neighboring countries and waterways, and the global economy shuddered under the impact of oil shortages and uncertainty. The White House dangled ill-conceived goals before the public to justify its nonsensical and illegal war. Regime change in Tehran, an end to Iranian support for allies in the region, the elimination of Iran's ballistic missile and nuclear programs. Now that it is clear that the Trump administration has failed in every way, and with growing economic unease threatening the midterms, President Donald Trump is finally ready to exit the Persian stage with his hands empty. Good riddance. This will be yet another historical episode the U.S. public would love to forget, but pretending the war never happened won't erase the consequences. The thousands of dead across Iran and the spillover theaters of Lebanon, Yemen, and the Gulf are the most irreversible of these consequences. Most of these dead were civilians, and their families will have a hard time moving on to the next news cycle. In the U.S., however, we never read much about the human cost of the U.S. and Israeli strikes, other than when the White House gloated over the assassination of Iranian officials. But we love to talk about the price of gas. Gas prices, opaque as their derivation is, at least have a visible impact on most household budgets. In contrast, the larger economic legacies of this war are incomprehensible. The estimated price tag for Operation Epic Fury, $34 billion, would pay for a surfeit of classroom teachers, school lunches, or college tuitions. Those numbers could be calculated, but the lost potential of that alternative investment in the future will never be known. The damage to the global economy and its spin-off tribulations of food insecurity, political instabilities, and investor anxiety are similarly lost in the midst of economic forecasting. Nor do we know the losses due to physical destruction in Iran or the wear and tear on the U.S. military. But the $300 billion so-called Reconstruction Fund that is part of the U.S.-Iran agreement and the 40% increase in the 2027 Pentagon budget to $1.5 trillion hinted at the resources squandered. Operation Epic Fury did not just waste lives and money, but also the already tattered credibility of the U.S. The rest of the planet has lived through too many decades of disconnect between U.S. ideals and policies to expect an elder statesman on the world stage, but they were expecting more than the ravings of a rogue state. These past few years have been a soberly fitting sequel to the disastrous war on terror, greenlighting the genocide in Gaza and shooting up boats in international waters, menacing NATO allies over Greenland, kidnapping the head of state in Venezuela, and now trashing the world economy in a tantrum aimed at Iran. This could be hard to live down. As tempting as it will be for the U.S., public to push Operation Fury into the past as if it were another unfortunate chapter best forgotten, it will live on in more ways than simply the deaths and debts it leaves behind. This was the first U.S. war driven with military targeting assisted by artificial intelligence. AI doesn't just speed up military operations, however, it also changes the deliberation process by escalating the march to war faster than policymakers, experts, and the public can respond. Not that Trump was, in any case, predisposed to listen. This war also introduced the first public assassinations of state leaders. The U.S. has been executing non-state actor opponents with legally controversial drone strikes for decades, but this war upped the firepower and the status of the targets. In addition, this war further undermined both the United Nations and the U.S. Congress by exposing their inability to hold Trump accountable to international or domestic law. And finally, this war, launched while the U.S. and Iran were in the midst of negotiations, undermined diplomacy in general and the U.S. State Department in particular by demonstrating, once again, how little regard the White House has for international commitments, ceasefires, or the rules of war. Neither our enemies nor our allies have any confidence in U.S. commitments at this point. Trump is now ready to declare victory and go home, but he has little to show for the costly war. The agreement signed last week settles nothing regarding the waterways, Iran's nuclear enrichment program, nor the continuing Israeli war on Lebanon. Nor was the war ever going to address the human rights situation in Iran or Palestine. Those issues won't vanish just because they've become inconvenient. They require sustained and credible diplomatic efforts, not a barrage of Tomahawk missiles. Operation Epic Fury may have seemed like a distant war for many in the U.S., but we will live here. We will live with and pay through the nose for a more militarized, unconstrained executive branch here at home as a result. Trump is ready for a new distraction, but we need to hold him accountable for this fiasco first. And here's another opinion piece by Steve Beckett, who has practiced law here in Champaign, Urbana since 1973. This essay is called Lincoln's Message for Champaign, Urbana. In 1854, Abraham Lincoln came to Urbana to attend circuit court, but he had a much broader message for his East Central Illinois brothers and sisters. Readopt the Declaration of Independence. It was a belief he'd held throughout his life. From the first time he read the American script inside an old Indiana book of statutes he'd discovered while a teenager. However, in Urbana that October evening, as he stood before a packed courtroom, he was not repeating history. He was recommending that history be repeated. His country was deeply divided on a collision course toward inevitable war over the issue of slavery. Today, it seems farcical that people could disagree over the right or wrongness of owning other human beings. But we must face reality. The remnant of that issue remains in America today. An element of our society pays lip service to the ideals of the American Revolution, but in their souls, they decry the ideal of American equality. Lincoln felt that the Declaration of Independence was not just a document used to thumb American noses toward King George III. Thomas Jefferson's words contained an incredible idea that formed the concept of a new freedom and underpinned a new country. He reflected that colonial people were disgusted with edicts from someone who, as a king, thought God had anointed him with power to rule over them. The basis of a United States of America was more than a mere revolt against royal power. The novel American credo was that all people could govern themselves, by themselves, and for themselves. Reminding his listeners that slavery was sinful and the foundational premise of America had plainly said so, Lincoln expected American society to return to the founding goal of equality. Later, in the U.S. Constitution, that goal would be part of a needed, more perfect union. Lincoln's logic was mathematical, Euclidean, in fact. Euclid had taught that if A is equal to B and B is equal to C, then A is equal to C. Nothing about life could change such a principle. Equal means equal. Euclid was teaching the latest generation through Lincoln's words that in the pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, all men are created equal. With that inspiration of equality in 1854, Lincoln noted it was obvious that slavery, while it existed in one portion of the country, must not be extended to the new territories of Kansas and Nebraska. Now Americans are reflecting on its mission to the world at the 250th anniversary of that great document. We are again deeply divided. We have the fear that everyday Americans will not enjoy that life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Our country's current direction is the wrong direction. Those with money have the power of governing all. Those who struggle have no power and do not govern themselves. Those in power believe there's a lesser class of day workers, immigrants, and people of color. To a corporate-dominated government, this lesser class does not matter. Lincoln's message in Urbana is no less clear for us today. Equal means equal, just as the Declaration of Independence reminds us today. All the people means all the people. And for America to demonstrate to the people of the world that our country is indeed unique and that it exists as a model for a better world, we Americans must readopt the Declaration of Independence in 2026, just as proclaimed when read by all Americans in 1776. Let me note that this article is accompanied by an image showing the highlight of the Champaign County History Museum's Forging Liberty exhibit of a local collector's Revolutionary War era artifact on display last weekend at the Champaign Public Library. This was a copy of the Declaration of Independence printed in 1843 by historian and archivist Peter Force for his American Archives anthology. The image shows the document laid out in a protective glass case. Well, that's all the time we have today for part one of today's News Gazette reading. Please stay tuned, and we'll return with the second half hour of today's News Gazette.